But how is it with those mentioned above who have kept Sunday in the past and the majority of those who are keeping it today? Do they keep it as an institution of the papacy? No. Have they decided between this and the Sabbath of our Lord, understanding the claims of each? No. On what ground have they kept it, and on what do they still keep it? They suppose they are keeping a commandment of God. Have such the mark of the beast? By no means. Their course is attributable to an error unwittingly received from the Church of Rome, not to an act of worship rendered to it. But how is it to be in the future? The Church, which is to be prepared for the second coming of Christ, must be entirely free from papal errors and corruptions. A reform must hence be made on the Sabbath question. The third angel proclaims the commandments of God, leading men to the true in the place of the counterfeit. The dragon is stirred, and so controls the wicked governments of the earth, that all the authority of human power shall be exerted to enforce the claims of the man of sin. Then the issue is fairly before the people. They are required to keep on the one hand the true Sabbath, on the other a counterfeit. For refusing to keep the true, the message threatens the unmingled wrath of God. For refusing the false, earthly governments threaten them with persecution and death. With this issue before the people, what does he do who yields to the human requirement? He virtually says to God, "I know your claims, but I will not heed them. I know that the power I am required to worship is anti-Christian, but I yield to it to save my life. I renounce your allegiance and bow to the usurper. The beast is henceforth the object of my adoration. Under his banner, in opposition to your authority, I henceforth array myself. To him, in defiance of your claims, I henceforth yield the obedience of my heart and life." Such is the spirit which will actuate the hearts of the beast worshippers, a spirit which insults the God of the universe to his face, and is prevented only by a lack of power from overthrowing his government and annihilating his throne. Is it any wonder that Jehovah denounces against so heaven-daring a course the most terrible threatening that his word contains? Number 13. The Closing Work. We have now seen what would properly constitute an image to the beast, such as the two-horned beast is to erect, and also the probability that such an image will soon be perfected in this country. And we have also learned what constitutes the mark of the beast, which is to be enforced upon all the people. An ecclesiastical organization composed of a greater or less number of the different sects of our land, with some degree of coalition also between these bodies and Roman Catholicism, together with the promulgation and enforcement of a general Sunday Sabbath law, would fulfill what the prophecy sets forth in reference to the image and the mark of the beast. And these movements, or their exact equivalent, the prophecy calls for. The line of argument leading to these conclusions is so direct and well-defined that there is no avoiding them. They are a clear and logical sequence from the premises given us. When the application of Revelation chapter 13, verses 11 to 17 to the United States was first made, as early as the year 1850, these positions respecting a union of the churches and a grand Sunday movement were taken. But at that time no sign appeared above or beneath, at home or abroad. No token was seen. No indication existed that such an issue would ever be made. But there was the prophecy, and that must stand. The United States government had given abundant evidence by its location, the time of its rise, the manner of its rise, and its apparent character, that it was the power symbolized by the two-horned beast. There could be no mistake in the conclusion that it was the very nation intended by that symbol. This being so, it must take the course and perform the acts foretold. But here were predictions which could be fulfilled by nothing less than the above-named movement respecting church and state, and the enforcement of the papal Sabbath as a mark of the beast. to take the position at that time that this government was to pursue such a policy and engage in such a work without any apparent probability in its favor was no small act of faith. On the other hand, to deny or ignore it, while admitting the application of the symbol to this government, would not be in accordance with either scripture or logic. The only course for the humble confiding student of prophecy to pursue in such cases is to take the light as it is given and believe the prophecy in all its parts. So the stand was boldly taken, and open proclamation has been made from that day to this that such a work would be seen in the United States. With every review of the argument, new features of strength have been discovered in the application, and amid a storm of scornful incredulity, we have watched the progress of events and awaited the hour of fulfillment. Meanwhile, spiritualism has astonished the world with its terrible progress and shown itself to be the wonder-working element which was to exist in connection with this power. This has mightily strengthened the force of the application. And now, within a few years past, what have we further seen? No less than the commencement of that very movement respecting the formation of the image and the enactment of Sunday laws, which we have so long expected and which is to complete the prophecy and close the scene. Reference has already been made to the movement to secure a union of the churches for the purpose of adding strength and influence to ecclesiastical movements in certain directions. And now a class of men is suddenly springing up all over the land whose souls are absorbed with the cognate idea of Sunday reform and who have dedicated themselves, heads, hands, and pockets to the carrying forward of this kindred movement. Organizations called Sabbath committees have been formed in various places and have labored zealously by means of books, tracts, speeches, and sermons to create a strong public sentiment in behalf of Sunday. Making slow progress through moral suasion, they seek a shorter path to the accomplishment of their purposes through political power. And why not? Christianity has become popular, and her professed adherents are numerous. Why not avail themselves of the power of the ballot to secure their ends? Reverend J.S. Smart, Methodist, in a published sermon of the political duties of Christian men and ministers, expresses a leading sentiment on this question when he says, "I claim that we have and ought to have just as much concern in the government of this country as any other men. We are the mass of people. Virtue in this country is not weak. Her ranks are strong in numbers and invincible from the righteousness of her cause. Invincible if united. Let not her ranks be broken by party names." In accordance with the logical development of these feelings, an association has been formed, now called the National Reform Association, which has for its object the securing of legal enactments for religious institutions by means of such an amendment to the National Constitution as shall place all Christian laws, institutions, and usages of the government on an undeniable legal basis in the fundamental law of the land. Here is the germ of religious revolution, the entering wedge of church and state. This movement originated at Xenia, Ohio, in February 1863, in a convention composed of 11 different religious denominations who assembled for prayer and conference. To be sure, the leaders in this movement disclaim vehemently any such purpose as a union of church and state, but a sentence now and then escapes them which reveals more than they intended. Thus, at a convention of this association in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Dr. Stevenson, one of these leaders, said, "Through the immense largesses it receives from corrupt politicians, the Roman Catholic Church is practically the established church of the city of New York. These favors are granted under the guise of a seemingly friendliness to religion. We propose to put the substance for the shadow, to drive out the counterfeit by the more complete substitution of the true." There are several guess roads through which we may look for the intent of this language. but inasmuch as they all arrive at one conclusion, this conclusion is neither ambiguous nor doubtful. It is simply that the Protestant Church shall become really established, as the Roman Catholic now is practically. This is confirmed by the very next sentence, which reads, "What we propose is nothing of a sectarian character. It will give no branch of American Christians any advantage over any other." Professor Blanchard undertakes to give a definition of what they mean by a union of church and state as follows. "But union of church and state is the selection by the nation of one church. The endowment of such a church, the appointment of its officers, and the oversight of its doctrines. For such a union none of us plead. To such a union we are all of us opposed." The reader is requested to mark this well. Here is given a definition of a union of church and state, such as no one expects or fears. Such, in fact, as is not possible in the existing state of the churches. And then a special plea is set up that they are opposed to a union of church and state. To such an impossible combination as they describe, they may safely write themselves opposed. But to a union of church and state, in the popular sense of the phrase, a union not of one church, but of all the churches recognized as orthodox or evangelical, a union not giving the state power to elect church officers, nor to take the oversight of church doctrines, but giving the churches the privilege of enforcing by civil laws institutions and usages of religion, according to the faith of the churches, or to the construction put upon those institutions and usages by the churches, to such a union we say they are not opposed. They are essentially and practically, despite their professions, open advocates of a union of church and state. We are not alone in this view of the subject. Mr. G. A. Townsend, New World and Old, page 212, says, "Church and state has several times crept into American politics, as in the contentions over the Bible in the public schools, the anti-Catholic party of 1844, etc. Our people have been wise enough heretofore to respect the clergy in all religious questions, and to entertain a wholesome jealousy of them in politics. The latest politico-religious movement, italics ours, is to insert the name of the deity in the Constitution." The Christian Union, January 1871, said, "If the proposed amendment is anything more than a bit of sentimental cant, it is to have a legal effect. It is to alter the status of the non-Christian citizen before the law. It is to effect the legal oaths and instruments, the matrimonial contracts, the sumptuary laws, etc., etc., of the country. This would be an outrage on natural right." The Janesville, Wisconsin Gazette, at the close of an article on the proposed amendment, speaks thus of the effect of the movement should it succeed. "But independent of the question, as to what extent we are a Christian nation, it may well be doubted whether if the gentlemen who are agitating this question should succeed, they would not do society a very great injury. Such measures are but the initiatory steps which ultimately lead to restrictions of religious freedom, and to commit the government to measures which are as foreign to its powers and purposes as would be its action if it should undertake to determine a disputed question of theology." The weekly Alta Californian of San Francisco, March 12, 1870, says, "The parties who have been recently holding a convention for the somewhat novel purpose of procuring an amendment to the Constitution of the United States recognizing the deity, do not fairly state the case when they assert that it is the right of a Christian people to govern themselves in a Christian manner. If we are not governing ourselves in a Christian manner, how shall the doings of our government be designated? The fact is that the movement is one to bring about in this country that union of church and state which all other nations are trying to dissolve." The Champlain Journal, speaking of incorporating the religious principle into the Constitution, and its effects upon the Jews, said, "However slight, it is the entering wedge of church and state. If we may cut off ever so few persons from the right of citizenship on account of differences of religious belief, then with equal justice and propriety may a majority at any time dictate the adoption of still further articles of belief, until our Constitution is but a textbook of a sect beneath whose tyrannical sway all liberty of religious opinion will be crushed." But it may be asked how the Sunday question is to be affected by the proposed constitutional amendment. Answer: the object, or to say the least, one object of this amendment is to put the Sunday institution on a legal basis and compel its observance by the arm of the law. At the National Convention held in Philadelphia, January 18 and 19, 1871, the following resolution was among the first offered by the business committee. Resolved, that in view of the controlling power of the Constitution, in shaping state as well as national policy, it is of immediate importance to public morals and to social order to secure such an amendment as will indicate that this is a Christian nation, and place all Christian laws, institutions, and usages in our government on an undeniable legal basis in the fundamental law of the nation, especially those which secure a proper oath and which protect society against blasphemy, Sabbath breaking, and polygamy. By Sabbath breaking is meant nothing else but Sunday breaking. In a convention of the Friends of Sunday, assembled November 29, 1870, in New Concord, Ohio, one of the speakers is reported to have said, "The question of Sunday observance is closely connected with the national reform movement, for until the government comes to know God and honor His law, we need not expect to restrain Sabbath-breaking corporations." Here again the idea of the legal enforcement of Sunday observance stands foremost, and the same principle would apply equally to individuals. Once more, the Philadelphia Press of December 5, 1870 stated that some congressmen arrived in Washington by Sunday trains, December 4, on which the Christian statesman commented as follows. We give italics as we find them. Number 1. Not one of those men who thus violated the Sabbath is fit to hold any official position in a Christian nation. Number 2. The sin of these congressmen is a national sin, because the nation hath not said to them in the Constitution, the supreme rule for our public servants, we charge you to serve us in accordance with the higher law of God. These Sabbath-breaking railroads, moreover, are corporations created by the state and amenable to it. The state is responsible to God for the conduct of these creatures which it calls into being. It is bound, therefore, to restrain them from this and from other crimes, and any violation of the Sabbath by any corporation should work immediate forfeiture of its charter. And the Constitution of the United States, with which all state legislation is required to be in harmony, should be of such a character as to prevent any state from tolerating such infractions of fundamental moral law. Number 3. Give us in the national Constitution the simple acknowledgment of the law of God as the supreme law of nations, and all the results indicated in this note will ultimately be secured. Let no one say that the movement does not contemplate sufficiently practical ends. What these national reformers desire and design to secure in their campaign is expressed by one of the secretaries of said association, J.M. Foster, in the Christian Statesman, October 1892. He says, "But one danger lies in this. The church does not speak as a church. The American Sabbath Union has done a good work. The denominations have spoken. But the Christian organized church has not officially gone to Washington and spoken. The work there has been largely turned over to associations. But the voice of God, authoritative, official, is through His church. Should there not be joint action of the denominations in this? They should, it would appear, appoint a joint committee to speak for God, and properly and courageously done, there can follow but the very same results. Much is lost by the church failing officially to speak at the right time and in the right place. No association is clothed with this authority. They are individual and social, but the church is divine. She can and ought to utter the voice of God in the halls of Congress as an organized church. The italics are as we find them, but other declarations in the foregoing extract are equally deserving of emphasis. It may well be questioned whether any more arrogant and pompous words were uttered previous to the setting up of the papacy itself. What they complain that they lack, they of course intend to have. And look at the picture. The church, that is the different denominations, confederating on dogmas held in common, and represented by a joint committee, a central authority, is divine, and woe unto all dissenters from the authority of a divine church. So said Rome in its palmiest days of dungeons, stakes, and blood. So she would say today, had she the power. And so apostatized Protestantism will say when it gets the power. And this joint committee is to speak for God, utter the voice of God. A second vicegerent of the Most High, now claimed as a monopoly by the Pope, and authoritatively and officially lay upon Congress the commands of God for it to perform. Such are the dark schemes for which these men are now working. Alas, that the realization of them should now stand as an attainable prospect before their eyes. Did ever Rome ask for more? And when these would-be spokesmen for God secure their object, will it not be, we still ask, Rome over again in a Protestant garb? A very image of the beast itself? Within recent years, the influence of the National Reform Party has been rapidly on the increase. It has now become international in its scope, and at frequent intervals holds world conventions, at which plans are laid to set up the national reform ideal of government in all other countries where it does not already exist. To this end, much is hoped for from the influence of Christian missionaries, many of whom have seemingly been captivated with the idea of converting heathen governments to Christianity, and see greater results to come from that than from the slow progress of converting heathen individuals. At a world convention held in Philadelphia, in November 1910, the following pronouncement was made on this point. This conference expresses its appreciation of the fact that so many missionaries are alive to the importance of the kingship of Christ over the nations, and we urge upon all missionaries in all lands the inculcation of these principles, and that they testify in their respective nations for the royal prerogative of Jesus in national life. Among those who participated in the program at this convention were F. E. Clark, president of the World's Christian Endeavor Union, Bishop Neely of the Methodist Episcopal Church, Reverend Dr. McCauley, District Secretary of the Federal Council of Churches, Attorney John A. Patterson of Toronto, representing the Canadian government, the Reverend David J. Burrell, President of the Alliance of Reformed Churches, besides missionaries from India and China, and from Roman and Greek Catholic countries. This affords striking evidence of the extent to which national reform ideas have permeated the religious world. Another most significant and alarming step toward the accomplishment of these evil designs is the position taken by the great Christian Endeavor movement, which has arisen to a membership of millions within a few years. It is a common channel through which all denominations can work. The political functions of this great body are centered in a Christian Citizenship League, which boasts that it will have branches in every state, county, city, village, and hamlet in the United States, and see to it that only Christian men are put into office. What remarkable conversions will then take place? How politicians will become Christians, and the millennium hasten on? At the Great Christian Endeavor Convention, held in Boston, Massachusetts, July 10 to 15, 1895, W. H. McMillan, as given in the published proceedings, page 19, said, "Here is a power that is going to wrest the control of affairs from the hands of political demagogues and place it in the hands of him who is king over all and rules the world in righteousness. Our political leaders have been counting the saloon vote, the illiterate vote, and the stay-at-home vote, and all other elements that have hitherto entered into their canvassings of probabilities. But they have not yet learned to count the Christian Endeavor vote. I want to serve notice on them now that the time is drawing near when they will discover that a political revolution has occurred, and they will be found coming home from Washington and our state capitals without a job." These sentiments were cheered to the echo in the convention, and it is not difficult to foresee the effect they will have, for they were intended for that class of men among whom they will do the most good, that is, the body of average politicians who, when threatened with a boycott, become the most abject sycophants on the face of the earth. All this, however, would be of no avail if those who are really patriots at heart would awake to this danger before they find themselves committed to movements the effect of which they did not foresee. And if the two houses of Congress would stand true to the Constitution which they are sworn to maintain, for this movement means nothing less than a subversion of that noble instrument. But alas, Congress has already turned its back on its sacred trust to fawn upon the church influence so rapidly rising. When the managers of the World's Fair of 1893 in Chicago asked Congress for an appropriation in their behalf, churchmen brought their influence to bear upon the national legislators and induced them to make it a condition of the gift that the gates of the fair be closed on Sunday. In carrying this point, a most remarkable scene occurred. A senator called for a Bible and caused the clerk to read the fourth commandment of the Decalogue, whereupon grave statesmen argued and at length by vote decided that the day enjoined by that commandment as the Sabbath is Sunday. This was legislating upon a religious question, which the Constitution expressly forbids. See Amendment 1. It broke down the barriers against the union of church and state, and opened the floodgates for all the evils that invariably accompany such a union. The religious amendment clergy hailed the event as a great triumph, and openly boasted that they had Congress in their hands, and could compel it to do their bidding.